Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Last Friday, I had kind of an interesting experience. I was invited to go to a half-day workshop meeting. It was called the Cal Future Forum, held up at the campus of UC Berkeley. And it brought together a whole bunch of people from Cal primarily. It was moderated by Michael Krasny from KQED, our local public radio station. And they were talks that were, very well rehearsed, nicely produced, much in the vein of a TED talk. And they were from people like Bill Collins and Inez Fung, Max Offhammer, Saul Shung, who I interviewed just a little while ago in Forecast, Alex Bayan, Christina Hill, and Asha Gadgil. And they were spanning a really wide spectrum of climate, economy, and sustainability issues. And, some of it was new to me. A fair amount of it I knew about in broad terms. But what was most interesting was just the meeting itself. It was sponsored by a company called Tencent. And before coming to the meeting, I had literally never heard of Tencent before. But it turns out that it's one of the biggest companies in the world, which, you think I'd be aware of this, but I actually was not. One of the executives from there is named David Wallerstein, and David became interested on his own, and I'm paraphrasing his comments from the end of the meeting, interested in issues of sustainability and climate, and tried to figure out who in the entrepreneurial space was looking at this. And from what he saw there wasn't a big list of big players in the field. And I think he wanted to at least do some things to try and bring these issues to the fore. He and Tencent sponsored this great half-day meeting to produce the kind of content that could be distributed more widely to this entrepreneurial audience. So that on its own, I thought was absolutely fascinating. So if you want to check it out, you can just do a search on Cal, just the letters C-A-L, Cal Future Forum, and it'll come up there and you can see the pretty long and impressive list of speakers that are there. Coming up towards the end of this week, I'm going to be going to it's a two-day meeting. I'm only going to the first day of the meeting, but it's at the Stanford Environmental and Energy Policy Analysis Center, or CPAC, out at Stanford, which looks at these overall issues of sustainability and the economy. This one's called Advances in Estimating Economic Effects from Climate Change Using Weather Observations. And I think this is going to be in the vein of what I talked a lot with Saul Shung about, which is how the community of climate and economy is really trying to bring in data, weather data from the impacts of weather and climate on the economic systems that they're interested in, and how this more data-based interaction is moving that field forward. I think that should be pretty interesting. And then on Friday, I'm going to New Orleans. My older brother is getting married there, so that's why I can't go to the second day of the meeting. Today, I'm talking with Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick from the University of New South Wales. It's an interesting hyphenated name, and one of the things we talk about towards the end of the interview is the issue that primarily women have to deal with when they're getting married, having a family, and trying to figure out how to manage their own name issues, which is an issue that men tend to have to grapple with less. It's like one of the long list of things that has major gender inequity in science and in society more broadly. But mostly, Sarah is working on issues of heat waves, climate extremes. It's on the same topic as the discussion with Yana Silman, which took place, I think, three or maybe four interviews previously. You can check that one out, too, if you'd like to. Sarah has been working primarily in Australia. And of course, Australia's had some really horrific heat waves. I mean, they're not as bad as the heat waves you might see in places like India. But for Australia, they've been quite extreme. And it turns out that I talked to Sarah when she was very late in her pregnancy. She's actually had her first baby since we talked. And she tells me what it was like living through those extremes in Australia in a badly insulated house, combined with a pretty bad air conditioning system and the desire to minimize one's carbon footprint. And I thought about the way that people like Sarah and her colleagues are dealing with extremes. It sort of seems like the causes of individual extremes are becoming clearer. So Sarah is working with her students on trying to understand the synoptic meteorology conditions that then interact with the land surface and also interact with these broader modes of variability like El Nino Southern Oscillation to control the seasonal currents of extremes, which remain incredibly difficult to predict. So there are strong elements of uncertainty with the prediction of individual extremes or seasonal occurrences of extremes. But one thing that really is quite certain is that if we keep down the path that we're currently on, vast increases in the number of extremes and their duration seem quite certain by comparison. If you change your emission pathway, so the rate at which you emit carbon, you might be able to delay the time at which this major shift could take place. But the shift itself in any kind of system of increasing emissions seems more or less like a fixed event, which it is. You know, it's kind of grim to think about. And I think that the larger question when we try to grapple with whether or not societally we should be trying to really mitigate emissions, not just to adapt, is like, what would adaptation really look like? And for Sarah, she explains how now when you're in Australia in the summers, you need to think about, you have to wear sun protection, you have to go out for a short time in the midday, if at all. But now it's things like, can you even go outside to hang up your laundry? And do we really want to adapt, which we could do? Do we really want to spend our energy in adapting to a world that would have such radical changes in lifestyle and be so incredibly expensive to adapt to? So I'm hoping that this particular interview will give you a flavor for the way that what we now view as extremes is poised to become essentially the normal climate in the future, and sharpen the need to still, even in the current political climate, talk seriously, perhaps not in the US, because that may not be possible, but worldwide, about the need to continue on with mitigation discussions. I had a great chat with Sarah, and we essentially just launched right into it. So here it is, me talking with Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick, a lot about life and science, women in science, but mostly about climate extremes.
Hi, Michael. How are you going?
Hi, Sarah. Good. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. I think actually we met last year about this. Oh, no, in Canada. There was a conference.
Oh, right. The Statistical Climatology Conference. Right. It. Yeah. That was quite a befuddling conference for me.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a bit intense on the stats side of things.
Well, I talked to this, like, stats people were bummed that there wasn't more stats.
Yeah, it's a bit of an, it's an interesting one because you have the, you know, people like me who are going to learn a bit more about stats and how they integrate into climate science. And then you have the hardcore stats going, oh, this isn't actually enough. So, yeah, it can be, but I always enjoy them. I think those conferences are every 3 or 4 years.
There was one in Edinburgh before, wasn't there?
That's right. Yeah, that was about 6 years ago.
And Korea.
Yeah, I didn't go to the one in Korea, okay. But yeah. But you're right, some of the stats talks were just way over my head.
Well, yeah, for me, it was more just the fact that I went into it because we have a lot more papers coming in stats and climate, and I wanted to get a better feeling for how to treat those and to better understand what the right methodologies were. And you come out realizing that on the stats side, there are no right methodologies, and that there's
no.
they're interested in developing their own algorithms, right? That's what they're keen to do.
Yeah, but there's no way of proving, especially if they're brand new, there's no way of proving if they're right or wrong. It's just another way of addressing the problem. Yeah.
Well, hey, thanks for coming on. I posed this question on Twitter about who should I get in the show, and you were one of the names that came up. It's like, great idea.
Well, you know, I'm so bored at home at the moment. I'm glad that we could squeeze it in before I had the baby. But I'm just like, oh, yeah, I'll do something, anything. Give me something to do.
You said you were 39 weeks?
Yeah, I'm 39 weeks. Oh, 39 weeks yesterday. So it could, you know, could happen at any time, but yeah, it's taking its sweet time.
Well, look, I mean, we've committed to the interview now, so you really have to finish the interview before anything else.
Oh, absolutely. Don't worry. I don't think it will be today. If I was getting nigglings, I probably would have cancelled. But yeah, I think we're good.
Is it your first child?
Yeah, first one. So they tend to take a while as well. Unfortunately, I'm so over it.
You know, I've talked to. Oh, you know, quite a few women on the show, and most recently talked to Nearly Abram, who's also Australian. And, you know, she made the comment that she couldn't imagine having the baby in the States or in a variety of other countries, because from her perspective, the support for having children and maintaining your scientific career was quite good in Australia. Is that, well, obviously
it's excellent.
It's a bit early to tell yet, but.
Oh, no, it's actually excellent. I am really surprised. So, in Australia, the government has to give you not the government, but each workplace has to hold your position for a year. So even if you don't get paid, you have to have, they'll have to, you know, keep your position open for a year. on top of that, where I work at the University of New South Wales, they actually give you, because I've been there over 5 years, yeah. they give me almost 9 months fully paid.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, and that's just like, that's very unheard of in Australia. That's excellent. I've never heard of maternity leave that good before. So I'm very, very, very grateful. So that just having that support, particularly my husband's still studying as well. So just to have, you know, no change in our income.
Yeah.
Is just, I like, yeah, I'm amazed and I'm so happy because it just means, I didn't expect it, to be honest. I didn't realize that it was that good.
Is it different for your friends around Australia who have had children in other universities or, for example, at CSIRO?
Yeah, look, most workplaces will give you, say, maybe 12 weeks full pay or, you know, 20 weeks half pay or whatever. And they still have to hold your position yeah. for a year. But you have to take at least some of that time not paid.
Okay.
And the government, at least at the moment, the government does pay you minimum wage for, I think, 18 weeks if you don't have maternity leave at all
yeah.
or maternity pay at all. So there is something. But the support, particularly, like, you know, in academia, it's so cutthroat. There's not very many women, you know, the further you go up the food chain.
Yeah.
So to have, you know, the university say, oh, yeah, you know, you've been with us 5 years, take 9 months off. It's just amazing. Actually, it makes me want to fight for my job a little bit more, just knowing that, you know, that support's there. And even going back to work, I think the university gives, I don't know if it's automatic or if you have to apply for it, but they give you something like $10,000 towards your research to spin you back up. You know, it's a flexible workplace as well. So if you need to leave a little bit early to pick up the kids from, you know, daycare or whatever, no one really cares as long as you do your work. It's actually a pretty good environment to have kids in that respect anyway.
Coming from America, this sounds like you're just completely making up a story to it just sounds impossibly good.
Well, there's no such thing as maternity leave in America. I can't get over that. I just, how do people afford to have children? I don't know, maybe the cost of living is different or whatever, but it's, I just don't get that.
I had a chat with Jana Silman, who also works on Extremes.
Oh, yes.
And she was saying that growing up in East Germany, which Americans were grown up sort of trained to believe is some sort of horrible place to grow up, was actually quite fantastic because it had wonderful maternity care and yeah. excellent child care. And that once they merged with West Germany, she realized that in a theoretically progressive society like Western Germany, there's a strong disincentive for women to develop professional careers because there's, like, ironically, yeah. you don't actually don't have good support for it.
No, and that's very true. Like even in Australia, when we have, you know, we have something better than nothing, there's, you know, it basically makes more sense for the woman to take time off work to raise the family. And you're right, there's a disincentive to work. Like one of my best friends, she's a school teacher. She would love to work full time,
yeah.
but they can't afford it because of childcare. So she's only working 3 days a week. Absolutely. Otherwise, there's no point because all her money would be going to childcare.
Yep. A lot of my colleagues here, they kind of keep working and pay for childcare, but they're completely just treading water. Like the childcare costs are yeah. equal to their income.
If you have more than one kid here, that's quite similar. We do get rebates back from the government, but they're not amazing. Like one kid will be fine. If you have two kids in childcare 5 days a week, it's yeah. pretty expensive.
Now, you've also been involved in outreach activities with UNSW, sort of workshops and conferences, web activities.
That's right.
About women in science. What do you feel, let's just say like in Australia, but maybe talking to other women scientists around the world with whom you work, like what are the main barriers that you're experiencing or they're experiencing as you move up, in particular, up the career ladder?
I think for me, it's definitely the lack of role models, and that's through no one's fault of trying. But, when I was doing my PhD, I was completely oblivious to the gender imbalance. It was just, you know, I did my work. No one treated me differently because I was a female. Mm-hmm. And still no one does. So I think I'm very lucky in my workplace at the moment. But the further you move up the academic ladder, the less and less women there are. And right. even in my situation, there's less and less women with kids. Mm-hmm. So it does make you consider whether or not you're doing the right thing. And, you know, for me, I've always wanted a family. That was just, it was going to happen one way or the other. Now I feel a little bit differently, but certainly when I got pregnant, I was thinking, can I do this? Can I balance a competitive full-time career, which I really enjoy,
yeah.
you know, to raising a family of two or three kids? You know, is that something? Is something going to have to break? So I personally find that a challenge because, you know, I think the gender balance at PhD student level is 50-50. Mm-hmm. But if you get to maybe an assistant professor level, it drops down to maybe 70-30. And the higher you go up, so if you get to a professor, which is, you know, the highest level in Australia,
right.
it's like 20-10 or 90, sorry, 20-80 or 90-10. So it's not really, you know, there's very much a balance towards the men. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think that kind of scares me, but I don't think scare is the right word. I think it's just a bit daunting. It'd be good to see females and go, you know, I can do that too. There are a couple, I do have a couple of role models in my workplace. I think, yep, they've done it, I can do that too. But it is a bit of a struggle for them because they're always, because they're one of the few females, they're always on these panels, whether it's a hiring panel or some other academic.
Yeah, they get used quite a bit for those kind of activities.
They do.
Yeah.
And I get that because they need to have that gender balance. And it's good that the university is pushing for this gender balance. But at the same time, these poor women are stretched so thin, they don't even have time for their own research.
Well, when you look at what women are doing relative to men, normalized for a career stage, what you typically find is that they're teaching more and doing more outreach activities and less research.
And that's right. And then also at the same time, we're still in this sort of pattern where women are the primary carer of the kids mostly. It's not always the case, but mostly. Mm-hmm. So it's this massive balance of everything, which is that's a bit daunting.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. So I know where I work. It's very progressive and they are moving towards this 50-50 balance, which is absolutely fantastic. But I think the university sector as a whole has a long way to go before that balance will ever be properly 50-50, if it ever happens.
So the 50-50 is aspirational at this point.
Yeah. So it's definitely something that where I work, that's what they're aiming for. And I know other institutions across Australia are trying to aim for something similar. Not everywhere, but most are. But yeah, it's definitely something that's more aspirational.
Even just having the goal is a critical part of the process. I mean, if you don't have the goal, you're certainly not going to reach it.
No, I totally agree with you there.
When I set out to do the podcast, I had the goal of doing 50-50 women and men. And I think if I hadn't had that, it would have tended more towards men just because I know more male scientists.
This is actually something that I struggle with. Like, you know, as I said, I want female role models. I'd like to think myself as a female role model maybe, you know, 10 years' time in my career.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you want to succeed because you're good at your job, not because you're female, not because of your race or anything like that. You want to succeed because you are the best person for that job. So it's, you know, that's kind of a catch-22 or kind of a conundrum that you, like, I find myself thinking, okay, well, I want to be good at my job, but at the same time, they need to hire more women. So that means that they must favor more women to get in there. So it's kind of this imbalance in trying to get the balance together, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I guess I've found that it hasn't been at all hard to do it. Just having a very, very slight change in mindset has made it incredibly easy to, and it, you know, I never have a hard time finding an amazing female scientist to come on the podcast.
Oh, that's good to hear. Actually,
no, absolutely not. It's completely easy. In fact, no worries at all.
Oh, well, that's good. That makes me feel a bit better. Cause I know, like, you know, especially where I work, cause they want this 50-50 balance, they will have to hire more females over males over the next 10 years. And that's fine to get that balance. But at the same time, I think most women out there want to be hired because they're the right person for their job, not because of their gender. So it's a kind of like, well, you know, we need more women there, but at the same time, we don't want to be favored because we're female.
Well, let's turn back to some of your own family background, because you've made a pretty remarkable change from, I think, the circumstances of your parents. So your father was involved in insurance. You're the youngest of seven children.
That's right.
I think three from your father and mother and four from a previous marriage of your father's. But you're the only one with a PhD. Your parents were not scientists by any means.
No.
How did you, looking at those role models, your mother is a role model. How did she conceive of her role in life? Was she happy with that? Did she want to do other things? And how did you begin to decide that you wanted to go down a different pathway?
Yeah, so my mum, unfortunately, she passed away when I was 20, so she's not been around for much of my adult life. In some ways, she was before her time, so you probably guess that I've come from a Catholic family with so many children.
You know, it didn't even cross my mind, honestly.
Really?
Seriously, I don't know what an idiot I am.
I was born very late to my parents, so it was very much a surprise.
Oh, okay.
She was, you know, she was brought up in this family where it was quite strict Catholic and everything. Just the way she dealt with life, you know, she was very independent, so she travelled a lot. She didn't get married till she was, you know, 32, which was quite late, you know, back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And didn't have her first child till she was 33. So she did her own thing. And I think I've kind of got a lot of that independence from her. You know, there's rules and yes, there's a course of life that you're meant to follow, but it's also okay to do your own thing. So even though both of my parents, you know, and that was the dumb thing back then. So when she got married, she had to quit a job, partly because she inherited four kids, but that's also just what you did back then. So she did have to do that, but...
Wait, just backing up a second. You said that she had to do that. Was that a job requirement or just a cultural requirement?
I think it was a cultural requirement. I know back then, or at least she hinted to me back then, that once you got pregnant, that was it. And she inherited four boys. I think they spanned in age from like 10 to 6 or something like that. They were really close together in age. So she had, you know, someone had to stay home and raise the children basically, and that was down to her. You know, even though that they came from, both of my parents came from very modest backgrounds, they encouraged us all to go through university or at least get some sort of tertiary education, which mm-hmm. we all did. So they at least valued the importance of education and learning. And I think that really came through with what I wanted to do, basically. I mean, my mum never knew that I did a PhD. My dad did. But I think she would have been very proud knowing that, you know, I had the potential, I enjoyed learning, you know, they encouraged me to stay at university and, you know, and follow my track. And that's exactly what I did.
So your six siblings, are they still in the Sydney area, and do you guys hang out a lot?
There's one in Canberra, so that's about 3 hours drive, and there's one in Melbourne, which is about an hour by plane. I would say that I'm probably a lot closer to my two sisters just because mm-hmm. we grew up together. Like we all get along really well. We all get along very well. There's, I think this child that I'm about to have will be the 18th grandchild in the whole family. So that whole sort of Catholic breed like rabbits thing has certainly permeated down to this generation.
Plenty of cousins.
Yeah, which is great. It's so good. Like sometimes I don't see my brothers for, you know, months just because we're busy, and they're so much older than me as well. Like they've got, you know, they have kids that are closer to me in age than my own sisters. So it's quite a dynamic family. But every time we get together at Christmas or Easter, it's just so much laughter and joy and so much respect. Like we're all very different, very, very different personalities. We all get along really well. No matter if there's, you know, some sort of drama or a bit of a fight, you know, we all get over it very quickly and just, you know, really, really hold it together. So it's really nice. I actually really value having quite a large family, and I'm glad even if I was a mistake, I'm glad that I was born into this one.
A blessing.
Yes, exactly.
So then you got your bachelor's in 2005. What was that in?
It was just general science.
Okay.
I found that I actually really enjoyed science, much to my own surprise. When I was in high school, I think when I was in high school, I went through every single other career out there. And then actually it was one of my sisters who was a school teacher. She encouraged me. She's like, oh, I think you'd be really good at science. I'm like, no, I'm never doing that. But I actually really enjoyed it. So I just decided to do a basic science degree. At that stage, my mum was quite ill with cancer. So I had great plans that maybe I'd find a cure for cancer, but then rapidly realized I hated working in a biology lab. So that went out the window.
Was it just too tedious?
Oh, too tedious, and just squirting little bits of chemicals into other little test tubes and all that. I'm like, no, this is just not for me. I can't handle this. So my backup was atmospheric science.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which I also really enjoyed. And, you know, I enjoyed doing geography at school, which kind of covered clouds and atmospheric processes. So that's the career I went down. But it was just a general science degree. But then I went on to obviously do a PhD.
Yeah. So you went on to University of New South Wales in Sydney, where you are now. Who did you work with for your PhD?
Professor Andy Pittman.
Oh, right. Sure. Uh-huh.
So he was at Macquarie, and I knew him because he taught me. And I actually started, I was very lucky, I started doing a master's program with him. And actually, I remember this conversation he had with me, like, oh, you should really consider doing a PhD. And I scoffed at him going, why would you do that? PhDs are stupid. I don't care. Blah, 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 blah. I just want to get out and earn some money. So he kind of, you know, he took that on the chin. He kind of smiled at me. And then I actually put the idea in my head. I'm like, oh, that'd be really good.
Maybe I should do that.
I kind of enjoy this sort of work. And then he actually, not long after that, he moved over to UNSW. Mm-hmm. And because actually my master's was going exceptionally well. So he said, look, you might be able to get credit towards a PhD if you transfer. So I kind of upgraded to a PhD based on the work I'd already done with my master's, which is actually pretty rare, but I was very fortunate. So obviously I had to do more work to get my PhD, but it worked out for the better, really.
And for your PhD work, at least in part, you were working on trying to understand how climate models are able to represent extreme heat and extreme events, but also in developing metrics that could be used to quantify the occurrence, which has been for a long time and still is a thorny topic in the field. How did you decide to begin approaching extremes, first of all, and then approaching them from those particular angles?
Yeah, well, I actually remember my supervisor throwing this paper on my desk at the beginning of, you know, what ended up being my PhD.
That sounds very confrontational.
Oh, it was, but that's fine. I worked quite well with that, actually. You know, basically saying to me, if you want to work with extremes, you have to understand this. And it was, at the time for me, it was a hardcore statistical paper on extreme value theory and how to apply it. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know
like
what,
you know. DEVs and Weibull functions
exactly.
And things like that. Yeah,
absolutely. And I had done second year stats at uni, so I wasn't completely clueless. But I'm like, no, I almost cried, actually. I'm like, there's no way I can do this. I should just quit. But somehow
I trial by fire.
Yeah. I think so. I'm also quite stubborn.
That's a great trait for scientists.
Exactly. And then he threw another paper on my desk by Lisa Alexander, who I'm actually, you know, she's a good colleague of mine now.
Oh, yeah. You published with Lisa quite a bit, it seems like.
Yeah. And he's like, you also have to be at this standard. I'm like, oh, my God. This is so difficult.
Wow. You got to set the bar high, right?
It did, but it works. I mean, I'm not quite at that bar yet, but it's kind of given me motivation to go ahead. So that's at least he pointed me to the methods of what I needed to use, but it was a huge learning curve to actually, you know, I don't know how many times I read papers by Francis Byers on how to apply extreme value theory to climate data. I had no idea what he was going on about for the first, I don't know, 30 times I read those papers, but all of a sudden something clicked and I got what they were saying, and it was also getting the language and getting the, you know, the syntax or the nomenclature of how they put their equations together, because that was all quite foreign to me. So a lot of hours were placed in. And also the whole evaluation of climate models. I think so. I was working with models from the third CMIP3 project.
So they're run at, I don't know, like 200 kilometer resolution, something like
200, that? 400, yeah. 200 was really good. I think more 300 to 400 was more like. So, yeah, they were pretty coarse. But before then, evaluation had only ever been on things like the mean climate, you know, like average conditions, monthly averages. And CMIP3 was the first round of models to produce daily data.
You mean the first one to archive it?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Archive's a good word. But they only did it for certain time periods. So, you know, a couple of maybe 20 to 40 years in the historical runs and then two 20-year periods in the future runs. So there wasn't a lot of data simply because we couldn't store it, but at least there was some daily data there. So I was one of the first people to actually evaluate the daily data, so which is important for extremes. If you can't get that sort of seasonal cycle of daily data, the frequency and intensity of extremes at that daily time scale, then your model's, you know, not fit for purpose really. So all we really did, I think the highlight of my PhD was just really evaluating the probability density function of daily data, which wasn't really that hard to do when I look back at it. But at the time, no one had ever focused on daily data before. So yeah, well, it's just firstly, it never really existed.
Yeah.
And secondly, no one really trusted the models were that good to look at daily data anyway. And there's still a lot of debate around that, which is, you know, healthy and you know, necessary. Yeah, so it was just, you know, basically do these two probability density functions match up in their shape and their, you know, in their height and other features, yes or no? And is that model good for, you know, those temperature or rainfall extremes? So it, as I said, it was quite simple, but it was quite novel at the time.
I mean, that's kind of where you have to start when you're beginning a field like that. At a high level, what were the main areas where the models and the observations were in broad agreement, and where were they in broad disagreement?
Well, given that most of the models are based on northern climates, they tend to not do so well over climates over Australia, which is what I basically focused on. I remember some models, I won't name them, but that was just
very good.
Yes, for Australia. Well, yeah, I respect the institutions where they come from, so I don't want to. But you just looked at the PDS and went, oh my God, that's so off. There's, you know, the climate was 10 degrees colder or warmer over Australia than what it really is.
So just
is.
Huge mean state biases, even beyond the.
And even the shape of the distribution, so the seasonality or the it was just completely out. And, you know, temperature was always better done. So rainfall is still very much a bit of an enigma when it comes to climate modeling. Main reason probably because we just still don't know how to get the clouds right.
Mm-hmm.
It rained too often and it wasn't extreme enough. That was very consistent across basically every climate model that we looked at.
So there's a persistent drizzle problem.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And when it does rain, like if you do get an extreme event, it's not extreme enough. And that's actually quite important over Australia, particularly in the tropics, because it's a tropical climate.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when it rains, it pours. Even in places like, you know, I live in Sydney, and even, you know, when we get rain, which is not usually that often compared to some other climates, it's a thunderstorm in the middle of summer, and you can't get a climate model to replicate those conditions. It's just not possible. minimum temperature was always better done. It's just a much easier variable for models to simulate. But we were surprised at the time how good the climate models got both minimum and maximum daily temperatures. They just seemed to get that distribution. The shape was beautiful. The extremes were reasonable. It was just, yeah, it was encouraging at the time, definitely.
Was the problem with the rainfall at all related to the diurnal cycle of convection, or was that not something that you could conceivably get into at the time?
Yeah, that wasn't really. We didn't really go that far in. So now it seems to be a necessary focus on why aren't these models getting this data correct?
Yeah.
At the time that I was doing this evaluation, it was just let's have a look and see how bad they are or how good they are, not necessarily diagnosing the problems. And that's, to be honest, I've actually moved away from model evaluation now, but there's definitely a push. Instead of just saying this model is good or bad, which is basically what I did, mm-hmm. let's see if it's good or bad and diagnose why that problem is. So I couldn't tell you if it was the convection was out or, you know, I'm purely speculating, but I think a lot of them, the convection was pretty awful. Yeah. And on top of that, you know, the resolution of the model is pretty bad, so you can't really, you know, you have to parameterize convection anyway, so it's not, you know, it's not well represented.
And then getting back to this metric idea, I mean, with extremes, it's the kind of thing, I was talking with Jana about this too, where I think everyone knows what a heat wave is, but there are a million ways to actually sort of quantify what we all agree is a heat wave. Where is the community in Australia? I mean, how did you contribute to that ongoing debate?
Yeah, I don't know if I have sometimes. Like, I really... the last four or five years, that's all I've done is research heat waves. And I still love doing it. But there was nothing, like basically the definition I would say is a prolonged period of excessive heat. They have to occur at daily timescales. In Australia, we never really have a heat wave over 7 days. They can be longer, but it's just quite rare. I know in Russia, you know, they had that heat wave that went for over a month. So yeah, it is possible for them to go very long. But there are so many different ways of defining them. And I know Jana's done a lot of work on these definitions. I have. There's different approaches. You know, do you just want to look at average temperature over a few days or maximum temperature? Do you want to look at how hot it's been or how long they go for, what area they cover? Do you want to bind that all into one big index, which is what some of the work Jana's done? There are so many different ways of diagnosing these events. And I think it's a bit unfortunate that that's happened because the way I see it and the way when I started researching this area, you had so many different people, both climate scientists and people from impact sectors, come up with all these different definitions without really consulting one another. So sure. They went, oh, yeah, this is what we think a heat wave is. Let's just come up with this metric. And it's worked for them. That's fine. But there's never been any sort of consistency on this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to approach the problem.
Well, I think it's an epidemic feature of climate science, but science in general,
that's
this
very
idea
true.
Of easily digestible concepts, but multiple definitions. I mean, the same thing happened with the hiatus. Much of the confusion there arose because people were all talking about different time periods and different metrics for what it actually meant.
Yeah. I totally agree with you there, but I would argue that the problem with heat waves is far worse. I have tried, I wrote a paper with Lisa Alexander in 2013 saying, right, this is, you know, let's kind of come together, guys. Let's kind of marry what we need from impacts and what we need from, like, what we can get from climate data. We can't get everything, and let's just kind of bring this together. And yeah, that paper's actually been well cited, so at least people are reading it, but people are still coming up with their own definitions. So it's almost like it's too far gone to fix the problem. You know, I'm not saying let's give up at all. Like, we still need to measure these events, but it is still difficult to say, well, how do we know how heat waves have changed consistently when we're using so many different definitions to measure them? And that can be a little bit hard. And also at the same time, we need daily data. We need good quality daily data to measure these events. And that doesn't exist everywhere in the world.
No, certainly not. Yeah.
And I did a paper in 2012 that tried to measure heat waves across the world, like from the observational record. Mm-hmm. The furthest I could go back was 1950. And I think I could only measure up until 2011. And that was definitely not everywhere in the world. There was large swathes of data missing for South America.
Africa.
Yeah, Africa, India, obviously. No one lives over Antarctica, so that wasn't measured either. And then that data set was really coarse. So it wasn't like I was looking at, you know, regional levels. It was just the way that the data was amalgamated to actually, you know, give it some sort of believability almost.
Yeah.
It had to be really coarse. So it does make it quite difficult to actually measure these events. But, yeah, I mean, we're doing the best we can. It's still a very interesting field, but there is literally a plethora of metrics out there to measure. There is actually, there is some good indices coming through. So work by Simone Russo and Yana Silman, they've actually come up with a definition that in some ways is universal. So you can, you know, you could take the Russian heatwave, for example, and the 2003 European heatwave and the summer that we had here recently. And it's you can compare those three events using the same index. So that's very clever. That takes into account the duration, the magnitude, and the spatial extent of the event. And then there's also, I think there's a really good definition here that the Australian Bureau of Meteorology uses that takes into account how hot a three-day window is prior compared to the prior month and also compared to some extreme threshold.
So kind of like a rolling normal in essence.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that index has been designed specifically to say, okay, we've got this heat wave coming. The bushfire services need to be prepared because it's quite hot relative to that month before. Right. And the health services need to be prepared because it's quite hot.
I suppose like that would, on an ad hoc basis, provide some understanding of the land surface interactions.
It does. Yeah. 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 So they kind of came up with that month window so that, you know, the month prior, I think by a bit of trial and error over the years. So whether or not they've said, oh, yeah, the land surface has that coupling over the month, that's when it's most important. I don't think they've quite gone that far, but it would certainly take that into account.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not perfect, but it's definitely like the forecast system, with the exception of the end of this summer, the forecasts have been really good. And they have used it to inform health impacts, saying, look, we've got this heat wave coming, up to you whether or not you do anything about it, but it's going to be a doozy. So you need to, you know, we advise you to do something to prepare for it.
Yeah, you've worked on that topic at least a little bit in your work on the idea of seasonal prediction, which is this exploding field of research. And for a lot of managers who control things like water and disaster relief and flood relief and things like this, it's one of the only things they actually care about. And for huge chunks of Australia, you know, you're largely controlled or at least strongly influenced by El Nino dynamics. And there's been this longstanding spring predictability barrier, and there've been this unending stream of ideas about how to get past that. And I think some part of the community feels that there's an intrinsic element of unpredictable nonlinear dynamics that you're just never going to get around. And you have a limited window, you know, from the spring window of the linear dynamics, but you're not going to get beyond that. What is your feeling on that specific topic, and what is happening with you and your colleagues in Australia on seasonal prediction for extremes?
Yeah, look, I would actually agree, because so for here it's the autumn predictability barrier within those,
yes, sorry,
because the seasons are reversed. But I would agree, like it's, with the exception of the, you know, the last big El Nino that we had that had already pretty much taken hold by now, all this talk of whether or not El Nino is going to develop and how bad it's going to be,
yeah,
I don't really think there's much truth in it. Like, I know the Bureau of Meteorology, so the whole ENSO cycle is a little bit out of my field. I've had a look at it in relation to heat waves and extreme events, but I don't study ENSO specifically.
Right, sure.
They are doing the best they can. There's a lot of research because, as you said, you know, it's El Nino is one, you know, arguably the biggest seasonal driver of climate in Australia. Mm-hmm. And we are so, you know, we have this massive agricultural community that's so dependent on having those seasonal forecasts out that are to do with, you know, rainfall and drought and all that sort of stuff. And it's a big problem here. But I think we've made incremental progress over the last maybe 5 or 10 years. And that's not through the fault of the researchers. They try hard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like the rest of the world, there's not a whole lot of research going into science funding, not as much as there used to be anyway.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, you know, we need more computing power. We need to run these simulations at higher resolutions or more of them to get that data out to make any progress. But we just don't have the resources to do it.
I mean, you have a window a little bit into some of these funding issues. I mean, you did a postdoc in 2009 to 2011 at CSIRO. And of course, CSIRO over the past 2 years has had this, I don't know what you want to call it, a controversy, a scandal about their withdrawal from climate funding. Going back to your own experiences at CSIRO, like, how does that organization work? Did you have major funding constraints then? And are you, I'm guessing you're really happy to be out of it now and in this...
Yeah, in
very
some
nice
ways, I am.
Academic job.
I enjoyed my time at CSIRO. I was only there for 2 years, but back then I was employed in a position that basically the government said, you need to research climate change over the Pacific. Here's a wad of cash. Hire some people. Go do it. That's
that sounds all right.
So there was this explosion of new hires, of which I was one. And it was great. But we used to, it's very much funded by the government, CSIRO. So it's not a private organisation. It's actually not technically a government organisation either. It sits somewhere in the middle. So they rely on some private funding and some government funding. And that government funding has been cut in recent years because the current government, and particularly our old Prime Minister, did not value science. So it wasn't just climate science that was affected. CSIRO researches many other different sciences as well. But climate science was particularly hard hit simply because Tony Abbott just thought it was all crap, basically.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And the new hire to head CSIRO, Larry Marshall, I don't know if he felt the same way, but he was heavily influenced by the government to make these decisions. So it's a real downer to see a great institution, and I still know many people that work there and respect a lot of them, to be so restrained by what the government is doing. You know, they are limited. They might have these amazing research ideas, but if it's not within the research plan or the funding isn't there to do it, then they can't do it. So if there's no research funding for seasonal prediction, for example, they can't go down that route.
Within Australia, I know that, so for example, for seasonal prediction, I would imagine that the wheat farmers in Western Australia who are dry, you know, their rain-fed agriculture would be quite keen to have better seasonal prediction. But
they would, whether or not the government thinks it's necessary is another matter. So, like, I know that in part a lot of that lies with the Bureau. So they do release seasonal forecasts, or seasonal outlooks, I should say, every 4 months. But it's only very general, just because that barrier that we were talking about earlier still exists. And there is, as you said, there is an explosion of research going into it. But whether, I don't know, I personally don't think we'll see the fruits of that labour for at least another few decades, just because there's so much chaotic variability that goes into that. You know, you might say, well, for example, what happened here, you know, we had this really hot summer up until mid-February, and then in Sydney it rained for a whole month. Like, I'm not kidding, every day it rained for a whole month. So it was, and it was still a hot summer on average, but you still have that month where that would completely blow out the seasonal forecast, for example. Yeah, there's still the element of that weather meets climate on the seasonal scale.
Well, that's been one of your main areas of research, I think, is trying to understand the role of internal variability versus any kind of a force component. And, you know, that also appears throughout climate science, trying to contextualize these two themes. And it seems like it's only going more towards understanding a bigger role for internal variability, even though you do have this long-term effect.
Absolutely.
Arising. Yeah.
I find this fascinating, actually, this whole internal variability thing. And this is what forms my, I guess, you know, it's not that we don't know, but it's still a very active area of intense research.
Yeah.
Because internal variability plays such a large role. And you could have a climate prediction or projection, or whatever you want to call it, for 20 years out. But, you know, that's not set in stone. There's a good, you know, level of variability around that simply because of the chaotic system of the climate and the weather state at that particular time. And that's something that I think only in the last 5 or so years, researchers have really started to understand and take note of. It's, you know, you can't just average climate models. You can't even just choose the best climate models, whatever those models may be.
Right.
You have to also account for the chaotic system of internal variability.
Which is absolutely enormous. And you've also done a huge amount of work on public outreach, talking to people both in the Pacific Islands but all throughout Australia. You've done a lot of work online in your own blogging activities. When you talk to people, ordinary citizens or like your family or your friends who aren't scientists, how do you what works when you're trying to explain this? When you're trying to say, okay, like summer 2017 was this horrendous heat wave. It was probably amplified or made much more likely by climate change, but there's also this component of natural variability. Like, what resonates?
That actually, basically what you just said in a nutshell usually works. It depends, you know, what words I use depends who I'm talking to. I actually had this really interesting conversation with my mother-in-law. My husband was actually born in January 34 years ago, and she was hell-bent on convincing me that that was the hottest summer they've ever had because she was telling me how hot it was while she was in hospital having him. So I pulled out the climate door. I'm like, actually, no, this is, you should argue with me about it. This is actually the hottest summer that we've had, and I was pregnant through it.
It was the hottest summer for her.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was a pretty hot summer, to be fair, in 1983, but, you know, 2017 did trump it. But, yeah, basically what you said. So climate change has absolutely increased the odds of having the summer we just had here, and that's undeniable. But because there's a lot of weather involved in that, and there is, well, you know, there is that link between weather and climate, but weather is inherently more chaotic.
Yeah.
you can never say that an event was explicitly caused by climate change. And I try and drive that home a lot. So trying to explain internal variability doesn't always work to certain people. Perhaps if I'm having a conversation with some of my friends that have a science degree, then I can, you know, say it. Yeah. I can talk about that a bit more. But it doesn't always work. You can, I think if I say, you know, it increases the odds or increases the likelihood or the chance of having an event like this, words like that generally work.
I talked to Susan Joy Hassel, who's made a career out of doing science communication and training scientists how to talk to people. And, you know, one of her main themes is that you can't just scare people. And when you're working on heat waves, I think you have like the ideal keys to just scare the pants off people. When you frame this, do you still try and bring in discussions about like choice? We still have a choice on how bad it's going to become. And how do you do it in a way that you don't freak people out?
Well, so I always start off by saying, you know, we've always had heat waves here. We've always had extreme events. And this goes for any climate, not just Australia. Extremes have always occurred. It's not like they're all of a sudden happening because of us. I make that very clear.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, that's what the skeptics jump on, particularly in Australia. Like, oh, there was a heat wave in 1880 something and, you know, people survived that. We've always had them. But now they're occurring more often because of humans. And we can measure that. We can measure that in the observational record, and we know it's going to get worse in the future. So when we see heat waves that occur now, we know that they're occurring more often because of climate change. Yeah, so I'd like, you know, I think by saying we've always had them, people go, oh, okay, so we're not, you know, it's not scaremongering. Like, they're actually acknowledging the fact that, you know, we have had extreme weather before, but now it's occurring more often. It's in some ways, though, it's a little hard to not scare people. And I think in some ways without realizing it, I might be a little more conservative when I talk to the media and talk to people in public seminars and whatever, because heat waves are scary. You know, here, if it's, especially with the summer we just had, if you're out, you know, going for a run in 45 degree heat, you would get seriously ill. If you're a builder working on a building site, and that's, you know, that's a common. You could die, yeah. And that's, but people, you know, there's this mentality in Australia, you know, suck it up, basically. It's hot. We live in a hot country. Deal with it. We've always had this sort of weather. And people think that they're going to be tough and go put up with this weather that's going to harm them.
Tell me about living through the summer of 2017. I mean, I've never lived through something like that.
Well, being pregnant certainly didn't help. some health professional told me that, oh, yeah, your core temperature is up half a degree when you're pregnant. And to me, it felt like it was up 10 degrees. I was hot all the time.
Yeah.
To top it off, we live in a very old weatherboard house in Sydney.
Oh, no.
And none of the houses here are very well insulated. And our air conditioner died. So.
Oh, my goodness. It was like 50 inside the house and you're pregnant.
Yeah. Well, it was, yeah, one night I measured it was 40 degrees just before we went to bed.
Oh, jeez.
And we don't usually use the air conditioner. That is an absolute last resort for us just because I'm so committed to not having a high energy bill. But it was one of those summers where we just would have had to use it. And I remember I was going to bed with face washers drenched in water on my feet and legs to try and keep myself cool.
Just for the evaporative cooling, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was awful. I mean, I couldn't – it's Australia. So we always – in summer, you should always be aware of not going out in the middle of the day and wearing sun protection and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's really – in our culture. But I was actually thinking, is it too hot for me to go and hang the washing out on the line? Even, you know, getting up at 6 a.m., is it too hot for me to take the dog for a walk? These were thoughts I was starting to have.
What you're saying, just in a nutshell, there is really kind of the choice that a lot of societies will have.
And exactly.
In terms of, you know, mitigation, but also adaptation. Because if you look at very, very hot and rich places, don't have people dying from heat waves because everything is air conditioned. But the choice for Australia would be, if you have heat waves coming all the time that are very extreme, you'd have to air condition every interior space. You'd have to insulate everything. And, you know, this would be a non-trivial change, both in expenditure, but also in lifestyle.
Well, and this is the thing. These are thoughts I'm having as a 33-year-old woman. What thoughts will my child be having when it's my age? You know, this is, I guess, you know, being pregnant has brought on a lot of these thoughts about the future for my children. But this is the thing. I guess maybe I took for granted, or maybe I was naive in thinking that I would never have these thoughts or these measures of adaptation because I do live in a developed world, and I accept that was very naive of me. But this is going to become the new normal. Like these heat waves, you know, this was the summer we had about 5 or 6 heat waves in Sydney alone. Mm-hmm. At least we got a reprieve. So we might have had a heat wave for 4 days. We had a couple of cooler days. Another one would come in. You know, this happened for about 6 weeks. There was parts of New South Wales which are very – very dry, that didn't have any reprieve whatsoever. So basically had a constant heat wave for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You know, what sort of decisions would they make? What, you know, how, if we have a heat wave over Sydney for 2 weeks, how on earth are we going to cope? There was, I remember one Friday actually, there was in the media, they were saying, could everyone please limit their use of electricity? So if your air conditioner is set to 18, put it up to 26 degrees. Turn off appliances that you don't need to use anymore. Turn your fridge up so it doesn't have to be as cold. Because they were worried that we would have to have rolling blackouts to kind of limit the supply of electricity.
During which case, you know, people, elderly and the infirm, would certainly start dying.
Absolutely. So if we had these rolling blackouts, there would be a lot of sick people. Hospitals would probably be okay because they have backup generators. But, you know, this is in 2017 when we have a population of 4 to 5 million in Sydney.
Yeah.
What's going to happen in 30 or 40 years when that doubles and we have these heat waves occurring more often? You know, we dodged a bullet this summer, at least in Sydney. Adelaide didn't. They had rolling blackouts and it was just as hot. What's going to happen? And to top it off, sorry, I know I'm going on about this, but it was a really frustrating summer. We have our own politicians arguing about how good coal is. So we're still very much a coal.
Oh, yeah, that was all over the news here.
Oh, my God. And that was infuriating to someone like me.
Passing around the lump of coal.
Oh, yep.
Oh, man.
Barnaby Joyce. Yeah, that's the saying. This, oh, you know, just turn on your electricity. That'll save you. And yeah, sure, having the air conditioner on will keep you cold. And we should be able to do that without necessarily burning all these fossil fuels, which are just adding to the problem. And I find that very frustrating because we don't have a very good access to renewable energies. We ourselves, as much as we would love to put solar panels on our roofs so I could use my air conditioner to my heart's content, we can't afford to do that. So even being, you know, even saying, okay, well, it's hot, we need to keep cool. We need to put measures in place to keep ourselves cool. We're very limited in how we can do that, at least in the short term. And there's all these discussions and maybe we should have more public places that are open, that are cooler, so maybe more public libraries or places that are air-conditioned. That ultimately is drawing energy, and ultimately there are buildings in Australia, at least currently, that do not have good insulation. So you'll cool this space, but you'll spend more money doing it because the cool air won't stay in. So there's this huge shift that we need to make in the next few decades to make sure that our adaptive capacity is optimized, because it won't just be the elderly, it won't just be the sick, it will be young fit people like myself that will also suffer.
I kind of feel like with really bad heat waves, we're going from a situation where you may have an occasional drive-by shooting to living in an active war zone where you have to wear body armor all the time just to stay alive.
Yeah, actually that's a very good analogy, and I would agree with you, because if we're going, you know, as I said, Australia's always been a hot country. You don't go out in the midday sun without sunscreen on. But if we're now thinking, can I spend 5 minutes out in the sun just doing a menial task? That's not a way to live. And it is, unfortunately, it is only going to get worse. And I don't know how to say that to people without scaring them.
No, it's difficult to do.
Well, a lot of the time people shut down. Like, they're, you know, I remember having these conversations with my father 5 years ago. And, you know, he was quite right. He's since passed away. He's like, oh, I don't mind. I'll be dead by then, Sarah. Don't worry about that. And some people, they do. They shut down because it's such a big issue. They don't want to think about it.
But the point to make then is that individuals still have the role to advocate for mitigation of climate change.
Yeah, I agree. I agree totally. It's just, I guess, encouraging and igniting that sort of drive to do that, that can be quite difficult.
Some questions like sea level rise contributions from Antarctica can go from, let's say, 0 meters of sea level rise to like 13 or 14 over the next centuries, depending on the emission pathway.
Yeah.
Are extremes as sensitive to mitigation pathway? Or is it just more of like a linear thing? You emit more, you're going to get a linear function of increasing extremes.
So I've just submitted a paper to Scientific Reports looking at this. Mm-hmm. So scaling.
Timely.
Yeah, timely. Wanted to get it in just before I had this baby, so thank God. So I've scaled changes in regional heat waves relative to global warming thresholds. Obviously, the higher the emission scenario, the more quickly these changes happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty much independent on the emission scenario. So I looked at RCP 8.5 and RCP 4.5 because they were the two ones that had the most daily data.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship was extremely similar. It was just the time scale at which those changes occurred. So
yeah,
RCP 8.5, you know, we can have global warming maybe around 5 degrees by the end of this century, whereas it's only about 3 or so degrees in 4.5. So that the change in heat waves during 8.5, which is where we're heading, is much more rapid.
So in other words, the ultimate point you get to isn't that different, but it's just the what you might call the emergence of this citizenship.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's much more linear when it comes to things like extreme events. It depends. Like, with heat waves, they're so complex. Looking at their peak intensity is very linear when scaled to global warming. It does depend on the region, but it's a pretty linear relationship. But really interesting things happen when you look at the length of heat waves. So looking at tropical regions, it's pretty soon, so maybe when we hit about 2 to 3 degrees global warming, the duration of heat waves and the number of heat waves you get at the season, they all join together. So basically you have this perpetual heat wave state during 5 months of the year. So when we hit 2 degrees, I think over some tropical regions, you might have, say, 8 separate heat waves per season. This is just an example. But after 2 degrees, so when you start hitting 3 degrees, you might get 6 or 5 or 4 separate heat waves. And when you look at the number of heat wave days, it's gone up astronomically. So basically you've just got this one long heat wave state relative to now. And that's concerning.
You've worked on self-organizing maps, but also clustering algorithms in terms of diagnosing, I suppose, where heat waves are and where they're going, how they're moving around. What's drawn you into exploring those kinds of techniques for cluster algorithms? Like, why is it actually needed for extremes, and what insights have arisen out of that work?
So if I'm absolutely honest, what drew me into that work was one of my PhD students. Mm-hmm. He wanted to approach this, and he actually had the skill set to do it. Mm-hmm. But it's just a way of diagnosing, as you said, clusters of weather, synoptic maps, basically, and seeing what occurs most often. So, the synoptic situation can always change. It's chaotic, it's variable. But kind of breaking those down into clumps and saying, okay, well, these are the synoptic types that we see regularly over whatever part of the world you're interested in. So what we decided to do that was diagnose over Australia the classical synoptic patterns that we see. And this particular student of mine led an evaluation of the CMIC-5 models to say, well, whether or not they get those classical features correct. Mm-hmm. Some of them are really good, some of them are really bad, as what always happens. But overall, we were reasonably impressed. And then we wanted to see which types or which patterns lined up most with heat waves. So is there, over different parts of Australia, is there just one or two types of synoptic patterns that drive heat waves or that are associated with heat waves? Yeah. You can't necessarily say if they drive them as yet. And that there are. So, over New South Wales, for example, you need to have a blocking high in the Tasman Sea, a persistent high in the Tasman Sea. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at Southeast Australia, so Victoria and Tasmania, it has to be a bit lower. There's also relationships with what goes on in the northwest of Australia in terms of tropical cyclones that drive heat waves over Southeast Australia, which is really interesting. Where that sort of pressure system has to sit for Western Australian heat waves is different again. So we kind of already knew this because when they do forecasts of heat waves, they kind of say, oh, yeah, this is where the high pressure system is sitting. But it was really diagnosing, breaking it down, going, all right, is that absolutely true? Are there exceptions to these rules? How the climate models get them, and how do these systems actually change in the future if they do at all when it comes to heat waves?
So by doing the clustering, you're able to firm up and better quantify our understanding of the synoptics that are behind the occurrence of spatial distribution of heat waves. Yeah, okay.
So it was kind of tying that sort of synoptic interaction of heat waves with climate change. And what this student's also done is just now incorporating the land surface into that. So mm-hmm. if you have a synoptic system, what is the land surface doing that particular time to, we haven't yet worked out whether or not it's the synoptic system driving the land surface interaction or vice versa, or are they just occurring together to get that particular heat wave? Yeah. But is there some sort of relationship there as to what's going on? So it's obviously not just synoptic systems that drive heat waves. You need this land surface feedback as well. But is there some sort of, classical pattern with what the land surface and synoptic systems are doing to drive heat waves over different parts of Australia? And there is. So he was finding with, the certain synoptic systems that we associate with heat waves, there's definitely this kind of pull with the land surface as well.
You mentioned that this was work coming out of one of your grad students. You're at the stage in your career where, at least when I was your age, I was just beginning to have grad students. And I found the experience of having grad students to be in some ways like just really wonderful, but in other ways, challenging in ways I hadn't expected at all. What's it been like for you getting to the point where you're now having to advise and mentor students? Has this just sort of been a seamless process for you, or have you had to bring on really new skill sets?
Definitely bringing on new skill sets. It was I honestly, I don't think I was ready.
Well, you're never really ready. It's like getting ready for being pregnant, right?
Absolutely. This is very true, but it's a lot more sudden when it comes to grad students. At least having a baby, you have 9 months to get your stuff together. But I was very successful in getting a research grant a few years ago, and embedded in that was actually getting some students. Well, at least I was only meant to get one student, but I somehow ended up with three,
That's a lot to have right away.
It is a lot, and it was a lot in a little amount of time. Luckily, I had a lot of good support at work. But, yeah, it was a bit of an eye-opener, just not knowing. I didn't think I was prepared. I didn't think I was at that stage of my career where I could properly mentor students. So I made that known to my old PhD student, who's helped me a lot, and also Lisa Alexander, who's a bit of a mentor of mine. And so they've helped me along the way and given me the support and showing me what to do. But it's also managing different personality types as well.
Oh, big time, yeah.
I've never had any run-ins or anything like that, but it's been a massive learning curve to, you know, work with how they work. And they're obviously not going to work like I do, and I never expected them to, but just, you know, some of them, it was very easy to follow what they were doing. Others, you had to encourage a bit more, and that's totally fine. But I think that was the biggest learning curve was, you know, yeah, working with how they work as opposed to just thinking, you know, they always know what they're doing, which they don't. I didn't when I was a grad student.
I think it's easy to forget. Well, I mean, for me, and I think a lot of my friends who are in grad school, you all go through this phase of, Why am I doing this? This is not possibly going to work out. I'm never going to get a job when I'm out of this. I'm just going to quit my PhD. But those aren't usually emotions that you communicate to your graduate advisor.
No. And I did try and make that clear. Like if you hit a rut or you're not cool or something's happening, I want to be as approachable as possible, but that still doesn't necessarily mean that they will. And I probably wouldn't have approached my PhD supervisor going, I have no idea what I'm doing. Why is this not working? Like, no one wants to look silly. But no, it's been great. Like, I have actually really enjoyed mentoring a team. You know, obviously it's part of my job, and I'm glad to have that as part of my job.
Yeah.
But it does take away from your own research too. Like, don't get me wrong, this is all this work that I've contributed to, but that's not your own research as such anymore. It's being led by them. And that's fine. That's part of the process.
Well, one part of the process that I've noticed with your publication record is that when you were in your graduate work, you were publishing, but then you've ramped up to just an amazing degree. And I think looking at your CV, you had something like 13 or 14 papers in 2016, which is just like a ridiculous level of productivity.
I think I had one that I was first author on, though.
How did that happen? I know you work with a lot of Europeans, a lot of Australian scientists. Is it just through collaboration networks that you find?
I remember speaking to Lisa on stage going, this is ridiculous. I have like one paper, and that was the one that I was first author on that I led. And she's like, Sarah, stop that. Like, look at all these other, you know, as you said, so it would have been 15 other publications.
Yeah.
Which I've contributed to. So a lot of that would have been my students. There was a few, maybe 6-7 of those papers have been my students, and just collaborating. There was a couple that came out working with people at ETH, so Eric Fisher.
Sure.
And I think, yeah, just a lot of them collaborating with Australian scientists without really realizing, you know, you have all these conversations with people, you read drafts, you put in scientific feedback, and, you know, it does result in a publication, so you should be included in that. But at the time, you don't really think like you're contributing to it because you're not necessarily leading that work. At least that's how I feel anyway. Like, it's all great science, and you're absolutely right. It goes towards your career, and it's, you know, you're definitely contributing. But it's very much a shift when you start getting grad students, when you start moving up the academic chain. It's not necessarily just your work anymore. You're contributing to the greater field, which, again, is how it should be. It's just a different way of approaching research, I guess.
How have you decided to stay, I shouldn't say mostly, but a lot of your publications have been and continue to be on Australia, although you have worked in other areas, of course. Like, how have you decided to sort of stay with this Australian focus? Has that been conscious? Has it been just because there were funding opportunities, or do you see yourself now working more internationally?
I would say it's led by the sort of research grants that I can get. So we have, I'm not quite sure what the funding body is in the US, but in Australia it's the Australian Research Council. And they need to see proposals that are like, oh, it's going to benefit Australian society, blah, blah, blah.
It has to have a really practical direct benefit to the country.
And even more so these days than when I got my last grant. So
yeah, they're really cutting down on whatever they call the public good research, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I think that, so I've just put in for another grant. Hopefully if it comes through, it'll be coming through by the end of this year. But, you know, have to talk about, you know, not just why it's good for science sake, but why it's good for, general public interest, which is really hard to sometimes put words through. Anyway, so that kind of dictates that at least has to have some sort of Australian focus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I understand probably Australian climate better than any other climate in the world just because I've lived here my whole life. But certainly now I am trying to break through. Like once you've got that money, of course you need to do what you said in the research proposal, but it is also, you know, somewhat easy to apply those techniques to looking at global stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And certainly, as I said, if I get my next lot of research funding, I will try and move away, not just from focusing on Australia, but looking at global stuff. So the last couple of papers that I've been involved in has seen sort of like a global push. So looking at that internal variability question with heat waves and looking at global warming relationships with heat waves has been, you know, a global analysis. So I think I definitely think it's more important to move away from just looking at one region. As interesting as I think Australia is, it's just a small piece of the whole puzzle.
You've made another choice in, I think, right in the middle of this massive publication explosion, which was to change your family name in a professional context. And this is not a choice that every woman makes when she gets married and changes her name. A lot of women keep their maiden name, but you made the choice to go with Perkins Kirkpatrick.
It's been a difficult one because, as I've talked about earlier, I come from a large family. I have no attachment to the Perkins whatsoever. It's four brothers. They've all got sons. You know, it's passed.
The line will continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the flip side, my husband's an only child. So for me to take Kirkpatrick, he didn't care if I took his last name or not. But for me to take Kirkpatrick was a big thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, because, you know, it's just easier. And legally, that's my last name. I'm not Perkins Kirkpatrick legally. I'm just Kirkpatrick. Oh, okay. And our children will be Kirkpatrick. But at work, you know, because I've established my publication record under Perkins, I thought it'd make more sense just to hyphen it and then people would know who I am still. Whether or not that was the right decision, whether or not I should have just ripped off the Band-Aid and gone straight to Kirkpatrick, I'm not sure. I kept Perkins, but one of the main reasons really why I decided to hyphen it was easeability when traveling. So some people warned me that if I was, say, at a conference and I was registered as Kirkpatrick and my bookings were under Kirkpatrick and all that, but my passport said Perkins, there'd be a lot of issues. So I thought, well, if I at least hyphen it.
Yeah, interesting.
And because I was always legally going to be Kirkpatrick, that was definitely what I was going to do, then that would just make it easier. So in terms of, I don't know, logistics, it's probably made life a bit easier, but a lot of people can't say Perkins Kirkpatrick because there's too many K's. Mm-hmm. And I remember doing a TV interview about a month after I got married and we had to do the take five times because she could not say my last name.
Well, on Twitter, you're Sarah Perk Kirk, is that right?
Yeah, that's it. Won't fit. Last name won't fit. I always get Fitzpatrick and Kilpatrick. Yeah. And my husband's like, yeah, get used to it.
For all of your fans out there, how would you like to be addressed in a professional context?
Perkins Kirkpatrick. I think that's to stay. Yeah, that's to stay now. Whether like I, in terms of changing it, I think any woman should do what she wants to do. I have actually one of my sister-in-laws is a partner with Ernst & Young, and she's married to my brother. She's Perkins at home, but she uses her maiden name at work.
Yeah.
And I think that's her choice. If that's what she wants to do, you know, if you want to hyphen it, if you want to keep your maiden name, if you want to take your husband's name, do what you want. It's your choice.
My wife's last name is Best, B-E-S-T, Best, as in good, better, best. And, you know, we had about a 30-second discussion about name changes when we were getting married. And, I had, with a name like that, no one is ever going to change their name from Best to something.
No, I was like, I'd probably keep Beth. But for me, like, you know, as I said, I always wanted to have a family and I just think it'd be a lot easier. If my husband's last name was Smith or something like that, Perkins Smith, I might have hyphened their names, but I'm not going to do that with Perkins Kirkpatrick. So, you know, as I said, legally it was always going to be Kirkpatrick, but that work issue was a bit of an enigma to solve. And I know some women who have kept it, they're like, nope, I've published under my maiden name. That's what I'm going to stick with.
Yeah.
And a grad student recently got married and she decided to change her last name and she's done that. She's ripped off the Band-Aid and everything's in her new last name now. So I think, you know, what you want to do, it is a hard decision, but it shouldn't have to be. Just, you know, do what you want to do. I'd probably advise against not hyphening it if you've got two reasonably long last names, but that's the decision I've made now, so I'll stick to it.
Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick from University of New South Wales is expecting a baby any day now and is doing, still doing, fantastic work on climate extremes in Australia and now globally. Sarah, thanks so much for talking today.
No worries, Mike. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for taking the time.
That was great. That was Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick from the University of New South Wales. Sarah, thanks again for the interview, and I hope things are going great with your new baby. If you'd like the show, you can subscribe to it, and you can do that on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music, and probably other ways that I'm not even aware of. Subscribing is nice because you'll get a notification when new episodes become available right away. You don't have to wait around for it to pop up on iTunes. Speaking of iTunes, I've gotten in some really helpful, nice reviews on iTunes. It turns out that they don't actually make any difference in the ranking, which I thought they did. And I thought maybe I could overcome the Heartland Institute podcast on climate. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like that's possible. I think it boils down to mostly just how often you produce content, and I just can't produce it anywhere near as often. So I thank you for that, but I don't think I'm going to win that particular battle, much as I would like to. You can reach me on Twitter. I'm at MWClimateSci through email, forecastpod@gmail.com. The show notes are over at forecastpod.org. As always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guest, and not necessarily nature or nature's parent company. Coming up pretty soon, I think I'm interviewing on Wednesday, Rob Meyer from The Atlantic. And The Atlantic is a fantastic magazine, providing high-level discussion of all manner of politics, entertainment, and societal issues. It's a great magazine. I love it. It's the only magazine that we get in our household as a paper copy. It's a fantastic read. And Rob is one of the writers there who is working on issues of climate and I think also technology. Anyway, Rob wrote up a very nice piece about a couple of papers we published in Nature about Antarctica. One was showing that there is lots of surface water, and one was showing that you have potential preservation of the Nansen ice shelf from high levels of surface water. So they were kind of like presenting different sides of the same story. And I thought Rob did a great job about discussing that fairly. So I'll be talking with Rob about that soon. Hopefully have that interview up within a couple of weeks. And yeah, we'll be talking about Bret Stephens at the New York Times, an issue that has come up repeatedly now on Twitter. And it's been it seems like a huge issue for the New York Times. The upper level people at the Times actually reached out to their subscribers who had canceled on that basis. It's a pretty unusual step. So I think there should be interesting discussions there about journalism and climate science. I'll talk to you soon about all that. And then after that, the moment you've all been waiting for, it's going to be a discussion of science, paleoclimate, but especially heavy metal. That might be like a month out, but stay tuned.